supply cuts off about 3 days from now.
You're forcing my hand. Either I agree to go now or you'll make me go anyway. It's a unilateral 3-day deadline.
It's an unintended consequence. Look at it from my point of view. Obviously, I don't want to be here when it goes from bad to worse. And obviously, when I leave here, I have no choice except go straight to Rapid City. What else could I do? The guy is messing with me. What would you do if you were taking rounds from a distant building?
I would call in an airstrike.
This is my version.
So I have 3 more days here.
But only as an unintended consequence. I'm not looking to save the world. She didn't reply. Jane McKenzie said,
Richard, 3 days is not possible.
Let's challenge that assumption, he said. Let's make it possible. They moved inside. Brammel took a chair and McKenzie took the other. Sanderson said she was happy sitting cross-legged on the floor. Richard laid out on his back, with his arm behind his head, and he stared at the ceiling and listened. They started out by making a list of what Rose would need, which was easiest done by making a list of what she already had, which was quiet and isolated accommodations and access to pharmaceutical-grade opioid medications in daily doses, wildly in excess of what any responsible physician could even contemplate. McKenzie said in the long term the accommodations were no problem at all, but in the short term they didn't exist yet. She and her husband owned no beach houses or hunting cabins. There was an original staff apartment over their stable block, but it would need new heat and a new bathroom. Reacher said,
Do you have a guest suite?
2, but they're in the house.
With you and Mr. McKenzie, a nice man and a good match. Is he going to be a problem with all of this?
No, he's going to be totally on board.
Are you sure?
Completely.
Okay, Reacher said. How about Rose lives in a guest suite until further notice? Put her in the east wing, facing the lake. You got a 6-acre yard, and I'm sure it's a quiet, leafy street. Not like living in the middle of Times Square. We need to make fast decisions here. We can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. McKenzie looked at Rose, who nodded. She agreed. She could afford to. It was about the future, which wasn't coming. The second item on the list meant they could never get there. McKenzie said,
We need to be realistic about the doctor. We haven't even started looking yet. I'm sure they're thin on the ground. I suppose the Internet will help. But we might have to wait for an appointment. And I'm sure they at least go through the motions. They'll want an initial consultation. Or else right now the right guy is on Anguilla playing golf. You know what this crap is like.
I don't, Reacher said.
2 weeks, she said. I live in that world. Trust me. This feels like a 2-week thing. Absolute bare minimum.
No one answered.
From deep in her hood, Rose said,
You're all very polite people, so I'll say it myself. I'm the big problem. How are you going to bridge the gap? How are you going to hook me up every day for 2 weeks, some of which will be spent on the road, a different town every night? You can't do it.
Again, no one answered.
The questions hung in the air. How are you going to bridge the gap? How are you going to hook me up? It was the snag in every plan, like a splinter in a banister rail. The rest was easy. Reacher could picture it all, except for that. The quantities were staggering. It would be a full-time job.
To
To fill the silence, Mackenzie talked for a spell about Lake Forest, Illinois. It sounded like a very nice place. Their house was a grand old Tudor with ancient bricks and leaded windows, and a long sloping lawn and a stone dock with a small boat and the glittering lake beyond as big as an ocean. Then Reacher realized she wasn't just filling the silence or bragging on her real estate. She was spinning some kind of shared twin fantasy from long ago about the lives they were going to have and what would be in them, like an ideal dream. He could understand how girls in landlocked Wyoming would want a waterfront. Now, Mackenzie was saying she had made it happen. It was right there, for the taking. She was saying, come live in your dream for the rest of your life, with its damp lawns and its mossy bricks. It was a masterpiece of gauzy seduction. Reacher could only imagine how much more power it had from one twin to another, down on some unknown level of intimacy. It was enticing, irresistible, worth sacrificing for. Great psyops, except he was left with a couple of questions. How are you going to bridge the gap? How are you going to hook her up? Down in Denver, Kirk Noble had gotten caught up in some other thing, and then he had gotten dragged into a meeting about something else entirely. So in the end, he left Billy to sweat way longer than 2 hours, closer to 4. He stopped and looked in the one-way window, good and carefully. He prided himself on reading the signs. Right away, he saw Billy was a hard-scrabble country boy, maybe 40 years old, lean and furtive, like a fox and a squirrel had a kid, and spent half the time baking it in the sun and the other half beating it with a stick. He wasn't sweating, and he wasn't shaking. He wasn't drumming his toe or picking a nail. Not a user. Not even a smoker. Such a guy would give nothing up. Except by accident. Foxes and squirrels had numerous admirable qualities, but they didn't get college degrees. There would be some kind of side door, some kind of trigger. Maybe approval. Billy was the type of guy who most likely never had much. Maybe he could be stroked into prideful reminiscences about the deals he had done. Maybe using the granular-priced jewelry as a show-and-tell example. He could recall how he came by each item. He could say, yeah, some chick had no money, so she gave me this. In exchange for what, Billy? Noble sent a runner to his office for the shoebox of jewelry. The impromptu conference broke up, and Reacher went out on the porch. Then Bramall came out. Reacher imagined Sanderson would replace him in the armchair. He imagined the sisters would talk. Not too long, he hoped. Bramall said,
"We can't fix this."
"There must be a way," Reacher said.
"When you figure it out, be sure to let me know."
"You sure you want me to? You have more rules than me."
"One of which makes me delinquent if I don't prepare a plan B on behalf of my client. At least a mental sketch. In this case, it would have to start with hospitalization privileges for Rose. No federal lockup. A private facility of our own choice. Secured, if they want, at our expense. Obviously, the guy to talk to would be Noble down in Denver. He has the discretion. We already have a relationship. I should maintain it. I should have answered his call. I'll have to answer the next one. I might need him in the future. We don't need Plan B yet.
Better to lay the ground.
If you answer the phone to him now, you'll have to tell him where Rose is, which will lead straight to Plan C, which is the whole thing falls apart. Or you'll have to lie to him,
which is technically a felony. Bramall didn't answer. Reacher said,
Will you do me a favor? Depends what it is.
Go ask Mrs. McKenzie if her sister mentioned whether Stackley is coming by again tomorrow.
Why?
I want to know. Bramall went in, but a minute later it was Rose Sanderson herself who came out. She sat where she had before, on the step, hooded, a yard away. She said,
My sister gave me money. I told Stackley to come back every day until it's gone, or until he runs out of product.
Reacher said, What happens when he does?
Sometimes they miss a day. I guess they go somewhere and get more. We're real happy to see them come back.
I can imagine.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. We both took the same history class. She nodded inside her hood. She said,
Morphine dates from 1805.
The hypodermic syringe dates from 1851.
A great combination, just in time for the Civil War, which left hundreds of thousands of addicts. Then World War I, same thing. Literally, millions of addicts in the 1920s.
The Army likes tradition.
World War I was also the start of large-scale facial injuries, millions of them by the end. The French called them the mutilés, the mutilated, which is a good word, because that's how it feels, and because it sounds like mutated, which is also how it feels. You feel yourself become a different person. There was an early type of plastic surgery back then, but mostly they wore tin masks. Artists would match them to their skin color. But nothing really worked. City parks had benches painted blue, where the public was trained to look away. That's where they sat. But most of them never went out. Most of them never saw daylight, ever again. Most of them died of infections, or killed themselves.
You don't have to convince me, Reacher said. I don't care what you chew.
But you can't get it for me. Not 14 days straight.
Suppose I could. Suppose you could get it forever. What would you do?
Seriously?
Give me an honest analysis. You like the truth.
She paused a beat.
I would party at first, she said. Big time. No more rationing, no more cutting patches. I would bathe in the stuff.
Dangerous.
God, I hope so. It's a world you don't understand until you're in it. There is no feeling better than tiptoeing all the way up to the gates of death, all the way up to the big black door and then knocking on it. It's a whole different zone. If I hear a news story about some other user dying due to some batch of something showing up unexpectedly strong, I'm not feeling sorry for the guy. I'm thinking, where can I get some of that good stuff? Not because I want to kill myself. Far from it, I want the exact opposite. I want to live forever, so I can get high every day. I'm sorry, Reacher. I'm not the person I was. I mutated. You should have found someone else's ring.
What next, after you're done partying?
Eventually, I guess I would have to tone it down. Probably get the IV if I can have it at home.
You think you can tone it down?
She nodded inside her hood.
I love it like crazy. But there's enough of the old me still in there, I know that. I made it through West Point and 9 years in the infantry. I could make it through this. As long as I knew I didn't have to quit entirely. As long as I knew the promise was always there. Maybe Saturday night, if I was good all week. I think I could get myself to that level.
And then what?
Then I'll hide out in my sister's house until I'm 100 years old, by which time we'll all be ugly, and I won't stand out so much. Until then, let's not be Pollyanna. There won't be any then what going on. I don't see how it could.
You could get a job.
You must have missed that memo.
He smiled. I work now and then, he said, laboring, a nightclub bouncer. One time I dug a swimming pool in Key West, Florida, by hand. I bet it's still there.
The psychiatrist came to see me in the hospital. There was a new school of thought about confronting issues head-on. No false comfort. I was an 04, don't forget. All grown up. I was supposed to be able to take it. They showed me the data. Employees with facial disfigurements upset customers and co-workers so badly that virtually 100% of them end up working alone in a back office.
Okay. Don't get a job.
Then we had long conversations about how much our personalities are tied up with our faces, about subliminal cues and nuances, something very fundamental. Later I realized the head-on stuff went only so far. Now they were being subtle. They were dropping hints. They were telling me my romantic life was over.
Porterfield didn't agree.
He was different.
Was he blind?
He had problems of his own.
Behind them, the door opened, and Mackenzie came out on the porch, followed by Bramall. Mackenzie looked like she had something to say, but Bramall's cell phone rang. He took it out and checked the screen. He said,
"It's Special Agent Noble, from his office in Denver."
He looked at Rose, then he looked at Reacher, asking for something. Reacher said,
"You want me to be the bad guy?"
He took the phone. He hit the green button. He put the phone to his ear. He said,
"Hello?"
Chapter 39 Noble asked why Reacher was answering Bramall's phone, and Reacher gave him a vague reply about Bramall taking a walk, maybe out of range, therefore leaving his phone behind. Noble said, "Mrs. Mackenzie hired Bramall, right? For actual money?" Reacher said,
"Yes. But not you."
"No."
"Then it's better I talk to you anyway. Can Mrs. Mackenzie hear what you're saying right now?"
"Yes."
"Move away."
Reacher held the phone up toward the ravine and mimed heading that way for better reception. When he got there, he stood on a rock and said,
"What's going on?"
In his ear, Noble said,
"I think you found the sister."
"Why?
Are you saying you didn't?"
"I'm asking how you think we could have."
"How hard could it be? She was in there somewhere."
"It's a very large area."
"That's a description," Noble said. "Not a denial."
Finding an entrenched individual in an unlimited acreage of forested land, peppered with abandoned cabins, is virtually impossible.
"That's also a description."
"I can do this all day long," Reacher said.
"I was in the army."
Noble said,
"I need Rose Sanderson."
"Why?"
"For information. I need to close a file."
"You have Billy for that."
"Billy is why I need Sanderson now. I think Billy is lying to me. He's boasting, either for fun, to tempt me into wasting time chasing rainbows, or just for the sake of his ego. Some dealers love to lie about how they can get the good stuff. It makes them look cool. They're the man, and so on. But before I can close the file, I need corroborating testimony from a customer, just in case. It's a cover-your-ass thing.
What did Billy tell you?
That he was still selling what he always sold. Domestic oxycodone and fentanyl, branded and packaged inside the United States.
Obviously, that's a boast, Reacher said. You told us it's impossible.
It is impossible. I can prove it. Literally, everything is barcoded every step of the way, literally every pill. We have access to their data. There is zero leakage now.
So he's boasting.
Except he knows things he shouldn't. There have been packaging changes. He knows the new promotional message on the inside of the hospital pack. No one ever sees that.
So he's not boasting.
Of course he's boasting. They track every conveyor belt and every package and every carton as it goes out the door, and they have GPS on the trucks, and they match the orders with the payments received. And if there's a mismatch anywhere, all kinds of red lights start flashing, which isn't happening. Nothing is going astray.
So which is it, boasting or not?
I would like to put my mind at rest. Either way, I need to ask Rose Sanderson exactly what she was buying.
Why not go up the chain? Surely a wholesaler's testimony would carry more weight than a customer's.
I don't know these people. It's an opaque network.
Won't Billy name names?
So far, he's playing the good soldier. I only got what I got by tricking it out of him sideways. I would need to start a whole new investigation. I don't have time. We can do it quicker this way. We don't need much. We're only closing a file. All she has to say is Billy is a lying asshole and he was selling regular Mexican powder all along.
Up at the house, Sanderson and her sister and Bramall were still on the porch. They were talking a lot, some kind of a big discussion.
Reacher said, "Okay, if I ever get the opportunity, I'll be sure to tell her what you need."
Noble said, "Where are you now?"
"It's a very large area."
"Are you at her place?"
"It's hard to pin down an exact spot."
"You're talking on a cell phone?"
"On an omnidirectional antenna, somewhere inside a giant circle the size of New Jersey."
Noble said, "Certain laws apply when a citizen talks to a federal agent."
Reacher said, "Sorry, I was waiting for the dramatic music."
"Do you know Rose Sanderson's current location?"
"Certain other laws apply when this citizen talks to a federal agent, mostly the ones about saving breath by skipping bullshit. I know how these things go, and I know you know, usually worse than expected. Therefore, you always have a plan B, so the main office sees a notch on your bedpost anyway. Anyone will do. You want Rose Sanderson on the record buying Mexican powder, just in case. She's your plan B.
She breaks the law every day.
You should forget her right now. Seriously, she would be a very serious blunder on your part. She was wounded in the face in Afghanistan. You met her twin sister. Think about it. Their photographs will be printed side by side in every newspaper in the world. The movie star and the monster. Before and after serving her country. Now you're busting her for pain medication? The backlash would be ferocious. The DEA would be ridiculed. I'm saving you from a PR disaster.
Do you know where she is?
In the state of Wyoming.
Are you refusing to answer my question?
No, Reacher said. I'll answer all your questions, including the ones you haven't thought of yet. Let's set up a call about 3 days from now, on two conditions. You butt out till then,
and you forget you ever heard Rose Sanderson's name.
Why 3 days?
That kind of question would fall under the butting out part of the deal.
I'm not going to negotiate with you.
Then suggest an alternative approach.
Oh,
yeah, there isn't one. So let's try to get along. I was an MP, remember? The same as you, except different clothes. I'm not out to screw you. I'm trying to do you a favor. This is one of those lucky things that happen from time to time. I take the tiny slice I want, which is Rose Sanderson, and you get all the rest. It's a big deal, I promise you. It will win you a medal and make you a hero. Even Mr. Bramall thinks it will be hailed as a major triumph and the capstone of an outstanding regional success story. It's something for nothing, Noble. The opposite of collateral damage. The boy detective would take that offer, I think, in the comic books. He knows it's how government business gets done.
You're not the government.
You never really leave, Reacher said. Not if you're the right kind of person. Noble said nothing. Checkmate, again. He couldn't argue. Not without saying, yeah, all our lives are bullshit. 3 days, Reacher said. Relax. Maybe take in a show. He clicked off the phone. He walked back to the house. Bramall met him halfway. Reacher gave back the phone.
3 days, he said. Plus he forgets about Rose. Nice work.
Thank you.
In exchange for what?
We let him pick up the pieces.
What pieces?
I'm sure there will be pieces.
You're saying you got an idea now?
More like a mental sketch, Reacher said. I need to ask you a question.
What question?
When you were in Rapid City, why were you eyeballing Scorpio's laundromat? What did you expect to see there?
Customers, initially. According to phone records, Rose called there once. Who else would call a laundromat? Only a customer, surely. Maybe she lost something there. Maybe she wanted to know the opening time. I wondered if it meant she lived nearby. Or had, at one time.
But there were no customers.
Only one or two.
Any other traffic?
None at all.
Did you watch the back?
A couple of bikes.
But no loading or unloading?
None at all, Bramall said again. It's not a loading dock, just a regular door.
Okay, Reacher said. Then Mackenzie came by and said she wanted to go find the cabins they would be sleeping in that night. Apparently Rose had told her there was a nearby clearing with 4 small houses all in a square. They were aired out and habitable. Apparently Rose kept them like that all the time because she felt it was a shame to see good things go to ruin. They found the right path, which was like all the other paths Reacher had seen, including most recently the path where the guy with the boots had aimed the rifle. Apart from that, it was easy going. After 100 yards, they came out on a clearing, exactly as promised, with 4 one-room houses built around a space about the size of a tennis court, like a tiny village. The houses were made of log, each one different, each one built like a serious structure, each one no bigger than a single-car garage. All 4 doors were unlocked. Bramall claimed one at random. Mackenzie moved in opposite. Reacher split the difference, facing south. In a city, the place would have been called a studio apartment, a living room with a bed in it, or a bedroom with a sofa in it, plus a token kitchenette and a tiny bathroom. Overspill accommodation for house parties, he figured. They ate
and drank and made merry at the big house, but came out there to sleep. Maybe four couples, who all knew one another. He put his toothbrush in the bathroom glass and came out to find Mackenzie watching him from the doorway. She said,
"My husband has started the search for a doctor. He's taking vacation days from work. He understands the parameters. Our housekeeper is preparing the suite. Mr. Bramall is ready to drive us all to Illinois. I'm sure his vehicle will be comfortable."
"I agree," Reacher said. "It's a fine truck."
"I guess what I'm saying is, the rest is up to you now."
"The rest?"
"Bridging the gap?"
"Okay," Reacher said. "That seems fair."
"If you can."
"I'm working on it."
"Will it be possible?"
"Rose will need to hang tough. I hope she can. She told me there's some of her old self still in there. She was smart enough to ask me to hold her ring, or self-aware enough. To some extent, she knows what she's doing. She can still think the old way. At some point, she'll have to trust us, and we'll have to trust her."
"When will we leave?"
"Tomorrow," he said.
They ate dinner together out of what they had brought from the grocery store. Rose was high as a kite and happy. She was mobile and animated. Under her hood and her foil, she laughed and smiled and turned from person to person and talked and listened and answered. Mackenzie laughed with her, half the time projecting boundless energy and support, like a tractor beam in a science fiction movie, something solid for her sister to lean on, and the other half of the time projecting hopeless bewilderment at her new situation. She was adrift. There were old-time fairy tales where the beautiful sister came home scarred, and all kinds of hidden anger and resentment were revealed, ahead of a warm and tearful resolution. But this was different. There was no narrative template. They were both the beautiful sister. They started level. There was no anger or resentment. There were no issues. They were the same person. Almost. Reacher saw the air between them ebb and flow, sometimes making them a single organism, like an aspen grove, sometimes making them separate, but never completely. They were a unit. They were a they. Always had been, always would be. But neither one knew how the current version worked, or even what it looked like from the outside. How would they describe themselves now? Would it have to be I and she, no longer we? These were not questions they had asked before. Then Reacher told them how he thought the next day might go. Bare bones, a rough outline, three steps, plenty of holes still to fill. Mackenzie was horrified. Bramall looked away as if to say, "Is that all you've got?" Rose quieted down, and Reacher felt her eyes on him under her hood. He felt careful appraisal. She was his main audience. She had the most to lose. She was a professional soldier. She knew no plan survives first contact with the enemy. After that, it was about luck. Or not. She knew that for sure. Afterward, Reacher asked Bramall to move his truck behind the house, out of sight from the mouth of the driveway. Then he walked up the cowboy's path to where he figured their quarters must be. He found them on the porch of a low log building made to look like an old-time bunkhouse. Two guys, not three, sipping from cans of beer. He thought they looked uneasy, with shock and guilt, presumably, and a more ancient humbling, the guy in the boots especially, where you fail to kill a man and then you look up and see him walking toward you. Some kind of an atavistic feeling, deep in the back of your brain, about your place on the ladder, from back when the only ladders were trees. Reacher said,
We live in crazy times.
Neither guy answered. Perhaps they thought he had earned the right to speak uninterrupted, like giving a lecture. Maybe a cowboy thing. He wanted to tell them no hard feelings, that he understood the pressure, how it distorted judgment. But in the end he didn't. Too complicated. Instead, he told them what they had to do for him. He spelled it out, step by step, and he walked them through it, and he gave them what they needed. He saw it was better than forgiveness. Their heads came up an inch, with new resolve in their eyes, as if they were subject to an older legal system, where through labor or forfeit, they could buy back their freedom. Richard walked back to Sanderson's place. It had a light on inside. He checked where Bramall had left the Toyota. It was safely out of sight. Not bad for the FBI. He walked back to his one-room cabin, the little village. Mackenzie's place had a light on, and so did Bramall's. All kinds of people going to bed. All kinds of preparations and rituals. Maybe lengthy. Maybe Bramall brushed his suit like a valet. No doubt Mackenzie had a complicated routine involving potions and unguents. For sure, Sanderson did. Richard got into bed. Log walls, log ceiling. He understood the appeal. They were solid and massive. They made him feel safe. Chapter 40. The cowboys were up at dawn, drinking coffee from tin mugs in rocking chairs on their bunkhouse porch. The sun came up behind the hills and threw a flat shadow across the plain. In her house, Rose Sanderson slept on. She was not a dawn riser. Fentanyl saw to that. Bramall was up, already showered and dressed, with his hair brushed and his necktie knotted. Mackenzie stirred and woke and lived a happy, oblivious moment where nothing had ever happened. Then she remembered, and half wanted to go back to sleep again, and half wanted to get up and do something, anything, for as long as it felt like progress. In the end, going back to sleep won the contest. For a short time. Outside, the air was cold. Early on a late summer morning, high in the mountains. An hour later, the cowboys walked down to the mouth of the driveway. They waited there, the same as they had the morning before and the morning before that, except now they were two, not three. They stood around, not talking, like part of the landscape, infinitely patient. In her house, Rose stirred and woke. She put her hand on her night table. Two patches, still there. She breathed out and sagged back on her pillow. It was safe to get up. Bramall had made coffee in his token kitchenette and was out on his porch drinking the last of it. Mackenzie was in the shower, hosing water through her hair. An hour later, the cowboys still waited. The sun climbed higher and came up over the ridge behind them. It dappled the trees where they stood and warmed the air. In her house, Rose was showering. Bramall was still on his porch, his coffee long gone, just passing the time. He was a man life had taught to be patient. Mackenzie was in her cabin in an armchair, on the phone with her husband, talking about doctors. An hour later, the cowboys were still waiting, waiting for the man, for their connection, for their hookup. Wasted hours, part of a user's life. They leaned on trees and breathed the air, soft and piney. In her house, Rose Sanderson was dressed in her silver top with the hood pulled forward. She had cut a new piece of aluminum foil and smeared it with new lotion and smoothed it into place. She was in her living room with the window open, in position, ready, as was Bramall, 50 yards away in the woods. He was sitting on a log. Mackenzie was 50 yards the other way, leaning on the trunk of a fir, with filtered sunlight playing in her hair. A minute later, at the mouth of the driveway, there was the sound of a straining engine and the scratch and patter of struggling tires, and the cowboys stood aside. The beat-up old pickup truck came out of the woods, carrying its camper shell on its back like a turtle. At the wheel, Stackley scanned ahead. He saw no black Toyota, no big guy, no one else. He eased to a stop. The guy with the boots walked over. Stackley got out. He said, "How's it going?" The guy said,
"You owe us."
"For what?"
"The big guy."
"You got it done?"
"Yesterday, in the afternoon."
"How did you do it?"
"Lured him in the woods and shot him with a rifle."
"Want to show me?"
"Sure," the guy said.
"But he's an hour uphill. We didn't want him found too soon."
"And how do I know you did it?"
"We're telling you." "I need proof. This is a very large fee we're talking about here."
"Two boxes each."
"Between you," Stackley said. Then he looked again and said, "There were three of you yesterday."
The guy said, "Indisposed?"
"With what?"
"Sore throat."
"I need proof about the big guy," Stackley said. "This is a business deal we got going here."
The guy with the boots put his hand in his pocket and came out with a slim blue booklet, silver printing, a passport, maybe 3 years old, a little curled and bent. He handed it over. Stackley opened it up. The big guy's photo was right there, a face like a stone. His name was Jack Reacher, no middle initial.
"From his pocket," the guy said. "Less messy than his scalp."
Stackley put the passport in his own pocket. He said, "I'll keep it as a souvenir."
"Sure."
"Nice work."
"We aim to please."
"But you caught me out," Stackley said. "Business is too good. I'm running low."
"What does that mean?"
"You'll have to wait."
"That wasn't the deal."
"What do you want me to do? Say no to someone else just in case you got it done, which, frankly, I didn't expect so soon? I can't hold stuff back on a theoretical basis."
"So you got nothing left?"
"Not much." The guy said,
"Want to show me?"
"Sure," Stackley said. He wasn't averse. A dwindling stock was a kind of advertisement all its own. The modern environment. Business was all about velocity now. It was rule one. He turned toward the camper door and came face to face with the guy from the passport. Reacher eased out of the trees and crept up within a yard of the guy. He was about to tap him in the kidney, but right then the guy turned around toward the camper door, so he tapped him in the stomach instead, just enough to fold him over. He used the same hand on the guy's shoulder to force him face down in the dirt, where he searched him. He came up with his own passport from one coat pocket, and a 9mm from another, and a .22 jammed in one boot and a switchblade jammed in the other. The 9mm was an old Smith & Wesson Model 39, with handsome grips made of polished wood. The .22 was a Ruger, not a vest-pocket gun, but it fit in the boot. The switchblade was a piece of junk, made in China, maybe in a toy factory. Stackley was huffing and puffing in the dirt and squirming a little, which Reacher thought was excessive for a guy barely hurt. He checked the pickup's cab. Nothing in the glove compartment, but under the lip of the driver's seat there was a mounting clip where a fire extinguisher might have been, except in this case the clip had been modified and was currently full of another elderly 9mm with wooden grips, in this case an old Springfield P9. Apart from that, there was nothing but drifts of old gas receipts and sandwich wrappers. Richard stepped back to where Stackley was lying, and he held the old Smith out at arm's length. He clicked the button and dropped the mag from 5 feet up. It hit Stackley in the head. Stackley yelped. Richard dropped the gun itself. Stackley yelped again. Richard did the same thing with the Ruger, mag and frame, and then the Springfield mag and frame. A total of 6 separate yelps. Richard said, "Get up now, Stackley." Stackley forced himself upright, a little bent over, a little pale in the face, all shook up, rubbing his painful head, facing the same kind of animal issues the 2 cowboys had the night before. You failed to kill a man, and then you look up and see him right there. Does he own you now? Richard said, "Open up the back of the truck." The doors were flimsy plastic. Stackley got them propped wide, then he stood back. Reacher pulled a blanket aside. 1 forlorn box, mostly empty. It had just 3 patches left in it, each one individually wrapped, all of them sliding around in a space made for more. Not much. Reacher stepped away. "Stocks seem to be running low," he said. "What do you do about that in the normal course of business?"
"I'm sorry, man," Stackley said.
"About the other thing.
I had no choice. I was told to do it. It wasn't personal."
"We'll discuss it later," Reacher said.
"There's a guy. I have to do what he says. He told me to. It wasn't like I wanted to. You have to believe that.
Later."
"I really didn't think these guys would do it. I thought I was going through the motions, that's all, so at least I could say I tried. It's their fault, really."
"I asked you a question.
I don't remember what it was."
"Your stock is low," Reacher said. "What happens next?" Stackley got a look in his eye, like some kind of a thought process was taking place back there. He looked up and then down. A junction, Reacher thought, or a transition. A change from one thing to another, from winning to losing, from hope to despair to surrender. Stackley breathed out like a sigh of defeat. He said,
"When I run out, I go get more."
"Where from?"
"It's a kind of warehouse where you drive in and line up. You wait until midnight."
"Where is the warehouse?"
Stackley paused a beat. "We have the special burner phone," he said. "We get a text message."
"Where is your special burner phone?"
Stackley pointed at the camper shell. He said, "In a locker and back."
Reacher said, "Get it for me."
Stackley stepped up and leaned inside. Reacher heard the snap of a catch. Afterward, he recalled a split second of fast, chaotic thought, like his whole life was flashing in front of his eyes, except it wasn't his whole life, merely his mistakes of the last 30 seconds, explained and analyzed and ridiculed and exaggerated to a ludicrous degree, to the point where in his mind he saw his name as a footnote in a psychology textbook about bias confirmation, in a famous case where a guy saw a movement in another guy's eyes and took it to mean exactly what he wanted it to mean all along. Stackley hadn't surrendered. Instead, he had thought hard and fast and seen a way out, a lifeline. The guy was no dummy.
The change in his eyes had been a movement away from losing and back to winning, from despair back to hope. Reacher had read it completely wrong, completely ass-backward, too optimistic, too willing to look on the bright side of life, which also screwed up his conclusion about the weapons. He had instinctively assumed once he had taken a Springfield and a Smith and a Ruger 22 from a guy, then you were pretty much done with finding more firearms, which had made it fun to take them apart and drop them on the guy's head. Whereas the psychology textbooks would say a guy with 3 could have 4. Dead easy. Especially a dope dealer who took things in trade. Dumb. Stackley straightened up and turned around. He had a gun in his hand, from the locker in the camper shell. The gun was an old Colt 45, worn steel, rock steady, maybe 9 feet away, 8, if Stackley braced forward for the shot. Hard to miss from there. The downside of being a big guy, a sudden evolutionary disadvantage. Too much center mass. Reacher watched Stackley's eyes. The guy was still thinking hard. Cost, benefit, advantages, disadvantages. All the reels were coming up cherries. In the short term, he could solve his immediate, this-minute problem. In the long term, he could impress Arthur Scorpio as a reliable guy who got things done. All by pulling the trigger. Right there, right then, just once. The only negative was location. Couldn't leave a corpse in the mouth of the driveway. It would need to be moved a mile into the woods. But he had the cowboys for that. They would trade labor for a free patch. For 2, they would carry a corpse to Nebraska. Reacher said, "Don't point the gun at me." Stackley said, "Why the hell not? It would be a serious mistake."
"How would it, man?"
Stackley raised the Colt, two-handed. He pointed it at the center of Reacher's chest. Like aiming at a barn door, he said,
"How exactly is this a mistake?"
"Wait and see," Reacher said. "Nothing personal." Stackley's head exploded. There was a wet thump, like a watermelon rolling off a table, and then immediately the flat crack of a supersonic NATO round in the air, and the antique bark of an M14 firing. Stackley's head came apart in an instant cloud of red mist, and fragments of it followed his body down, vertically, like a disappearing trick, into a puddle of clothes and limbs and lifeless flesh. Reacher looked back at the house and saw Rose Sanderson at her window, checking downrange, assessing her aim. Which was pretty damn good, he thought. From 100 yards out, she had put a round through the gap between himself and the cowboys, and she had hit Stackley right above the ear. All with a rifle dumped by the army 20 years before she was born. Impressive. She came out of the house and walked down toward them, hood forward, carrying the rifle one-handed. From the right, Bramall came hurrying in, and from the left came Mackenzie, who had the most trouble with what she found. Theoretically, she might have been happy with what turned out, in pragmatic terms, and maybe even moral terms, but a human head shattered by a high-velocity rifle bullet was far from theoretical. It was a purple mess, steaming slightly in the cold mountain air. She turned and looked at her sister. She was prepared to kill people, and I wasn't. One thing to talk about it, a whole different thing to watch it happen. Reacher said, "Thank you, Major." Rose said,
"How much did he have?"
The thing that mattered most.
Not much, he said.
Shit.
She stepped around Stackley and looked in the back of the truck. She twitched the blanket aside and poked around. Her shoulders slumped. Not exactly surprise, but certainly disappointment. No plan survives first contact with the enemy. She looked back at Reacher as if to say, "This one went south pretty damn quick, didn't it?" She said,
"Where does he go to get more?"
He said, "The conversation didn't get that far."
"Arthur Scorpio's place, right?"
"No," Reacher said. "There's no traffic at Scorpio's place. No loading or unloading. Whatever Scorpio does, he does it by remote control."
"What exactly did Stackley tell you?"
"He said there's a warehouse where they drive in and line up and wait until midnight."
"Where?"
"He said he gets a text message on a burner phone. He said the phone is in there." He heard the click of catches and the muted thump of compartment doors being opened and shut, maybe 12 of them. The camper shell had lockers all over it, like living on a boat.
"There's no phone in here," she said.
"There never was," he said. "It was a decoy. It was a way to get to his gun."
"So how do we know where to go?"
"We don't." She just stood there, tiny, slumped, defeated. She was a drug addict. She had just shot and killed her dealer. Catastrophe, like jumping off a building. Right then, she was in mid-air, falling fast, the hiss of terror loud in her ears. She was going to panic. Reacher said, "Forget the phone. The phone was a trick. He invented it. They couldn't possibly work it that way. A warehouse big enough to drive in and line up can't be a movable feast. It can't be a last-minute arrangement. It must be a permanent location, fixed and secure, hidden away somewhere." Rose said, "But where?" Bramble said,
"Where's his regular phone?"
He ducked down, a small, meticulous figure amid the gore. He dug through Stackley's crumpled pockets. He came out with a Samsung smartphone about the size of a paperback book. It had a cracked screen. No password. Bramel dabbed and swiped.
"He replaced Billy 3 days ago," he said. "Obviously, he would have had to pick up supplies."
There were no text messages from 3 days before. No emails. But there was a voicemail. Bramel played it and listened and narrated as he went. He said,
"There's a service road leading to a covered garage. The covered garage is for snow plows and other winter equipment. There's plenty of space, and they have it all to themselves. There will be a guard at the door."
Reacher said, "Where?"
"It doesn't say."
"It must." Stackley was new.
"It doesn't. Maybe it's somewhere he was already familiar with. Maybe they already told him the general area."
"Who left the message?"
"Sounds like a transportation captain. He's all about the details."
"Is there an area code?"
"Blocked number." "Terrific."
Rose Sanderson went back to the camper shell. She leaned in and came out with the 3 wrapped patches. She gave one each to the cowboys. For old time's sake, Reacher figured. A parting gift. And like a good officer, always make sure your men are okay. She kept one patch for herself. She took another from her pocket, the last of yesterday's purchase. She butted them together and then fanned them out like a tiny hand of cards. She counted them. 1, 2. Then again, in case something had magically changed. 1, 2. Then again, obsessively, same result. She said,
"This is not good."
Reacher said, "How long?"
"I'll be getting sick by tonight."
"Where would we find snowplows?"
Are you kidding? Everywhere. Billy had a snowplow.
At his house. I mean big machines stored in a covered garage.
An airport?
Bramall said.
Denver, maybe.
Richard said.